Hey everyone, and welcome back. Are you ready to unlock the secrets of life itself?
Sounds exciting.
It is. We're diving deep into biochemistry today.
Awesome.
Yeah, we're tackling module one of BCHM 270, which is like this intense university level biochemistry course.
Wow, a deep dive.
It is a deep dive. And by the end, you'll be fluent in the language of life.
Yeah.
From like the tiny building blocks of DNA all the way to CRISPR.
So it's kind of like we're going on like this microscopic safari.
Mm.
But instead of lions and tigers and bears.
Oh my.
We're going to be encountering the molecules that make life possible.
I love that. A microscopic safari. Okay, so let's start with the basics. Nucleotides.
Okay.
They're like the letters of our genetic alphabet. They make up DNA and RNA.
Right.
And you know what's really cool? You're probably already familiar with ATP.
The energy currency of the cell.
Yeah. But did you know that ATP is actually a nucleotide too?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. It's kind of mind-blowing.
It is. It's amazing how these like tiny little molecules play such diverse roles.
Yeah, they really do.
And so just like letters form words, nucleotides link together to create these long chains of DNA, and then they twist into that famous double helix shape.
Yeah, the double helix. It's like the celebrity of the molecular world. But what makes it so special?
It all comes down to like those precise base pairings. You get adenine A always pairing with thymine T.
Okay.
And cytosine C always pairing with guanine G.
Right.
And this pairing is what allows DNA to like store genetic information and make copies of itself, ensuring that those instructions get passed down accurately.
So it's like a molecular safety deposit box.
Exactly.
Keeping our genetic code secure and ready to be replicated. What about RNA, though? It's kind of like the rebellious cousin of DNA, right?
Exactly. RNA prefers to go solo, so it's single-stranded, and it swaps out thymine T for uracil U.
Oh.
Plus, it uses a slightly different sugar molecule.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these tiny little differences actually make a huge difference in their roles within the cell.
So how do all these building blocks actually make life happen?
Well, there's this fundamental process called the central dogma.
Okay.
That explains how DNA, RNA, and proteins all work together. Think of it like the instruction manual for building and running a cell.
Okay, so the central dogma is the instruction manual.
Precisely.
I'm ready to decode it.
All right, let's do it.
Yeah.
So the central dogma describes this flow of genetic information from DNA to RNA to protein.
Okay.
And this flow basically underpins every single process in a living organism.
All right, well, walk me through it. How does it actually work?
Okay, so it starts with replication, where DNA makes an exact copy of itself.
Okay.
This ensures that every new cell gets a full set of genetic instructions.
Makes sense.
Then we move on to transcription, where DNA's instructions are transcribed into a message called messenger RNA or mRNA.
So it's like creating a blueprint copy of a specific section of the DNA code.
Exactly.
Okay, what happens next?
That blueprint, the mRNA, travels out of the cell's nucleus to these tiny little factories called ribosomes. And that final step is called translation. And ribosomes read the mRNA instructions and assemble amino acids into proteins.
So each of these three processes is a vital step in the production line. We go from the master plan in the DNA to the actual workers, the proteins that get things done.
Exactly. Each step is crucial. And here's something even more fascinating.
Okay, what's that?
The genetic code, the language that all of these molecules use, is universal. So the same three nucleotide sequence called a codon.
Okay.
Codes for the same amino acid, whether it's in a human, a bacteria, or even a plant.
Whoa, that's mind-blowing. So there's like this universal language of life connecting every living thing on this planet. What happens when there's like a typo in this language, though? A glitch in the code?
That's where we get mutations, those permanent changes in the DNA sequence.
Mutations.
And while the word mutation might sound kind of scary, not all mutations are actually bad.
Oh, really? Tell me more about these good mutations.
Well, some mutations are just harmless variations.
Hmm.
You know, they contribute to the diversity of life. Like, think about all the different hair and eye colors we see in humans. Those differences come from variations in our DNA sequence.
Oh, okay. So it's like nature's way of experimenting and adding a bit of spice to life.
Exactly.
But what about the mutations that do have an impact?
Well,
can you give me an example?
Imagine you're copying a recipe, but you accidentally switch one letter, like flour to floor.
Okay.
That small change could make your cake taste terrible.
Right.
That's kind of like what happens with a missense mutation. A single change in the DNA code leads to a different amino acid being incorporated into a protein. And that one change can have a significant effect on how that protein functions.
It's incredible how such a small change can have such a big impact. So I'm guessing there are different types of these mutations, right?
There are, yeah. Another type is a nonsense mutation.
Okay.
So instead of substituting one amino acid for another, these mutations create a stop signal in the middle of the protein's instructions. It's like suddenly ending a sentence mid-thought.
Ooh.
The protein often ends up truncated and can't do its job properly.
So it's like hitting a roadblock before reaching your destination. These mutations sound pretty disruptive. Are there any that are even more dramatic?
Absolutely. Think about reading a sentence where someone's like inserted or deleted a letter. The entire meaning can change. That's what happens with a frameshift mutation. By adding or deleting nucleotides, you shift the entire reading frame of the genetic code.
Oh, wow.
And you end up with a completely different and usually non-functional protein.
Okay, so now that we have a solid grasp of the building blocks and how they work together, let's talk about how scientists actually study and manipulate these tiny molecules.
Okay.
What tools do they use?
That's where the incredible world of biotechnology comes in. It's like having this toolkit filled with high-tech instruments that give us the power to analyze and even modify DNA, RNA, and proteins.
Okay, I'm ready to explore this molecular toolkit. What's the first tool we're going to unpack?
Let's start with restriction enzymes. So bacteria actually use these enzymes as a defense mechanism. They cut up invading viral DNA.
Oh.
But scientists have cleverly repurposed them as molecular scissors.
Okay.
Able to cut DNA at very specific sequences.
So we're basically borrowing tools from bacteria to manipulate DNA. That's pretty cool. But why is this cutting so important?
Well, it's useful for a variety of techniques. For example, we can use restriction enzymes to cut DNA into smaller fragments, making it easier to analyze. Or we can use them to insert a specific piece of DNA into a carrier molecule called a vector.
Okay.
Which can then be used to clone that DNA.
Cloning. So we can actually make topples of specific DNA sequences. What's the purpose of that?
Cloning allows us to do things like study genes in detail or produce large quantities of a specific DNA sequence for research or medical purposes. We can even engineer organisms with desired traits.
Wow.
It's a really powerful tool.
It is.
With far-reaching applications.
Okay, so we've got our molecular scissors. What other tools do we have in this biotechnology toolkit?
Next up, we have gel electrophoresis. Think of it like a molecular racetrack.
Okay, a racetrack.
Yeah. So we use an electric current to separate DNA fragments by size, with smaller fragments zipping through the gel faster than larger ones. This creates a distinct pattern of bands that we can visualize and analyze.
It's like a fingerprint for DNA.
Exactly.
Each pattern tells us something unique about the DNA sequence.
Exactly. And this technique isn't limited to DNA. We can use it to separate RNA molecules and even proteins.
So it's a versatile tool for analyzing all sorts of biological molecules.
Very versatile.
Are there any techniques that build upon this separation process?
Absolutely. Southern blotting is a classic technique that takes gel electrophoresis a step further. It allows us to detect specific DNA sequences within a complex mixture. It's kind of like finding a needle in a haystack.
Oh, wow. That sounds incredibly useful.
It is. Especially when you're dealing with vast amounts of DNA.
So how does it actually work?
After we separate the DNA fragments on a gel, we transfer them onto a membrane, kind of like making a blueprint.
Right.
Then we use a labeled probe, which is a single-stranded DNA molecule designed to bind to our target sequence. If that target sequence is present, the probe will stick to it, and we can visualize that binding.
So it's like a molecular detective sniffing out our DNA sequence of interest.
Exactly. And speaking of molecular detectives, we also have DNA probes. These are single-stranded DNA molecules that are designed to bind to specific target sequences.
Wait, are those similar to the probes used in Southern blotting?
They are similar, but DNA probes can be used in a much wider variety of applications. For instance, we can use them to detect mutations or polymorphisms in DNA. We can identify specific genes within a genome or even track the movement of DNA within a cell.
So they're like versatile tools for all sorts of genetic investigations. I'm sensing a theme here. A lot of these techniques are about finding specific sequences within a sea of DNA. Are there any tools that help us amplify those sequences to make them easier to study?
You're absolutely right, and that's where PCR comes in.
PCR, what's that?
It stands for polymerase chain reaction, and it's truly a game changer in molecular biology. Think of it like a molecular photocopier. We can use PCR to amplify a specific DNA sequence exponentially.
Wow.
Creating millions or even billions of copies from a tiny starting sample.
That's incredible. Why is this amplification so important?
It allows us to study DNA sequences that are present in very small amounts, like those found in forensic samples, ancient DNA, or even single cells.
Hmm.
PCR has revolutionized fields like genetics, medicine, and forensics. It's made it possible to analyze DNA in ways that we never could have imagined before.
It sounds like PCR has opened up a whole new world of possibilities for studying DNA. Are there any other techniques that have had such a major impact?
Definitely. Microarrays are another powerful tool that have transformed the way we study genetics. Imagine a tiny chip with thousands of DNA spots, each representing a specific gene or DNA sequence. This allows us to analyze a vast amount of genetic information simultaneously.
So it's like having a genomic snapshot, allowing us to see the big picture of gene expression or genetic variation.
You got it.
What kinds of questions can we answer with microarrays?
We can use them to compare gene expression patterns between healthy and diseased cells, identify genetic variations associated with certain diseases, or even screen for drug targets. Microarrays have become an indispensable tool in research and diagnostics, giving us insights into the complexity of the genome.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground already, from molecular scissors to genomic snapshots. Is there anything else in our biotechnology toolkit that we should be aware of?
We've saved the best for last. CRISPR-Cas9 is a revolutionary gene editing tool that has taken the scientific world by storm.
CRISPR-Cas9? That sounds familiar. I think I've heard about it in the news.
It's been making headlines for a good reason. This system, originally discovered in bacteria as a defense mechanism against viruses, has been harnessed by scientists as a powerful tool to edit DNA with incredible precision.
Hold on, I'm a bit confused about CRISPR. Could you explain how it actually works to cut and edit DNA?
Think of CRISPR-Cas9 as a programmable molecular scalpel. We can design a guide RNA that matches the DNA sequence we want to target. This guide RNA then leads the Cas9 enzyme, which acts like molecular scissors, to the specific spot in the genome.
So it's like a GPS system for DNA editing.
Precisely. And once that Cas9 enzyme makes a cut in the DNA, we can either let the cell repair it naturally, potentially disrupting the original gene, or we can introduce a new piece of DNA to be inserted at that cut site.
So it's like we can rewrite the code of life. But what are the implications of this technology?
The potential applications of CRISPR-Cas9 are vast and exciting.
Yeah.
But they also raise important ethical considerations. We can use it to study gene function in unprecedented detail. We can develop new therapies for genetic diseases, engineer crops with improved traits, and even potentially correct genetic defects in human embryos.
Wow, that's a lot to process.
Yeah.
So CRISPR is a really powerful tool with the potential to transform medicine, agriculture, and even the future of humanity.
Absolutely. It's a tool that demands careful consideration and responsible use. You know, we need to have open discussions about the ethical implications of this technology to ensure that we harness its power for good.
Okay, so we've explored the foundational concepts of DNA, RNA, and proteins, and we've unpacked a whole toolkit of biotechnology techniques. I'm feeling like a molecular biologist already.
You're well on your way. Understanding these fundamentals is crucial for grasping the more complex biochemical concepts that we'll be exploring in future modules.
I can't wait to see what other secrets of life we'll be unlocking. But for now, I think it's time to give our brains a break and let all this information sink in.
Agreed. We've covered a lot of ground today. But don't worry, we'll be back soon to dive even deeper into the fascinating world of biochemistry. Now that we've gotten our hands dirty with like the basics of DNA, RNA, and proteins, let's switch gears a little bit and explore some of the techniques that scientists use to analyze these molecules in the lab.
Okay, I'm ready to put on my lab coat and goggles. What kind of RNA techniques are we talking about?
Well, remember how we discussed southern blotting for DNA?
Mm-hmm.
There's a similar technique called northern blotting that lets us examine RNA. It's kind of like taking a snapshot of gene expression, showing us which genes are active in a cell or a tissue at a specific moment.
So it's like a behind-the-scenes look at what genes are up to in real time. Why is it important to know which genes are active?
Gene expression is like the control panel of the cell.
Okay.
It determines, you know, which proteins are being made and in what quantities. By analyzing RNA, we can get a glimpse into the inner workings of a cell and understand how different genes contribute to various processes like development, disease, or even response to environmental changes.
That makes sense. But what if we want to go beyond just seeing which genes are active and actually measure how much RNA is present?
That's where quantitative PCR, or qPCR for short, comes in handy. It's a really powerful technique that allows us to precisely measure the amount of a specific RNA molecule in a sample.
So it's like having a molecular measuring cup for RNA.
Yeah, exactly. With qPCR, we can compare the levels of a particular RNA between different samples like healthy versus diseased tissue or cells treated with a drug versus untreated cells. This allows us to study changes in gene expression in response to various factors.
Okay, that sounds incredibly useful for understanding how genes are regulated. But what if we want to analyze a whole bunch of genes at once?
For that, we turn to cDNA microarrays. These are similar to the DNA microarrays we talked about earlier, but instead of DNA, they contain complementary DNA, or cDNA, which is synthesized from RNA.
So it's like a reverse transcription of the genetic code.
Precisely. By analyzing cDNA microarrays, we can see which genes are being actively transcribed into RNA in a particular cell or tissue, giving us this global picture of gene expression patterns.
It's like having a panoramic view of the cellular landscape, showing us all the active players in a specific biological process.
Exactly. Now let's move on to the protein techniques, shall we?
Let's do it. Proteins are like the workhorses of the cell.
Yeah.
So I'm eager to learn how scientists study them.
One of the most common techniques for analyzing proteins is SDS-PAGE, which stands for sodium dodecyl sulfate polyacrylamide gel electrophoresis.
Whoa, that's a mouthful. Can we break that down a bit?
Of course. Basically, SDS-PAGE is a technique that separates proteins based on their size. We use a detergent called SDS to denature the proteins, giving them a uniform negative charge, and then we run them through a gel matrix using an electric current. Smaller proteins move faster through the gel, while larger ones lag behind.
So it's like a molecular sieve, sorting proteins by their weight class.
That's a great analogy. And once those proteins are separated, we can visualize them as distinct bands on the gel. This allows us to determine the size of a protein, compare the protein profiles of different samples, or even purify a specific protein for further analysis.
Okay, so we can separate proteins by size, but what if we want to target a specific protein within a complex mixture?
That's where antibodies come in. These remarkable proteins are produced by the immune system to recognize and bind to specific foreign molecules, like viruses or bacteria.
So we're basically borrowing the immune system's targeting system to study proteins.
You got it. Scientists have harnessed the power of antibodies to develop a wide range of techniques for detecting and analyzing specific proteins.
That's pretty clever. Can you give me an example of how antibodies are used to study proteins?
One of the most widely used techniques is Western blotting.
Okay.
It combines SDS-PAGE with the specificity of antibodies to detect a particular protein within a complex mixture.
Wait, so it's like a combination punch, using both size separation and antibody targeting.
Precisely. We first separate the proteins by size using SDS-PAGE, then we transfer those proteins onto a membrane similar to Southern blotting. We then incubate the membrane with an antibody that specifically recognizes our protein of interest.
Okay.
If that protein is present, the antibody will bind to it, and we can visualize that binding using a variety of methods.
It's like a molecular search and rescue mission, using antibodies to pinpoint our target protein within a sea of other molecules.
Exactly. Western blotting is a powerful tool for detecting and quantifying specific proteins, studying protein expression levels, analyzing protein modifications, and even identifying protein interactions.
Okay, so we've got antibodies that can recognize and bind to specific proteins. What other tricks can we do with these molecular detectives?
Another widely used technique is ELISA, which stands for enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay.
ELISA, okay.
It's a very versatile technique that allows us to detect and quantify proteins or antibodies using these enzyme-linked reactions.
Enzyme-linked. So we're using enzymes as reporters to signal the presence of our target molecule.
That's the idea. In ELISA, we typically coat a surface with an antibody that specifically binds to our target protein. Then we add our sample, and if that target protein is present, it will bind to the antibody. We then add another antibody that also recognizes the target protein.
Okay.
But this one is linked to an enzyme.
So it's like a molecular sandwich with our target protein stuck between two antibodies.
Exactly. And that enzyme linked to the second antibody allows us to detect and quantify the amount of target protein present. When we add a substrate that the enzyme can act upon, it produces a detectable signal like a color change or fluorescence, which is proportional to the amount of target protein in the sample.
It's like a molecular beacon signaling the presence and quantity of our target protein.
Precisely. ELISA is widely used in research and diagnostics, providing valuable information about protein levels, antibody responses, and even the presence of specific pathogens.
Wow, we've covered a lot of ground in this molecular toolkit exploration. It's amazing how scientists have harnessed these techniques to study, like, the intricate workings of DNA, RNA, and proteins.
It really is a testament to human ingenuity and the relentless pursuit of understanding, you know, the complexities of the molecular world. And we're just scratching the surface. There's a whole universe of techniques out there, each with its own unique strengths and applications.
It's mind-boggling to think about all the discoveries that are being made using these tools. What are some of the areas where these techniques are having the biggest impact?
One area that's particularly exciting is molecular diagnostics. Imagine being able to detect a single nucleotide difference in a gene that could determine whether someone is susceptible to a particular disease or whether they'll respond to a specific medication.
That sounds like personalized medicine at its finest. Sure. Are these techniques being used in clinical settings today?
Absolutely. Molecular diagnostics is rapidly transforming the way we diagnose and treat diseases. We can now use these techniques to identify genetic mutations associated with cancer screen for infectious diseases, determine the best course of treatment for a particular patient, and even predict an individual's risk for developing certain conditions.
It's like having a crystal ball for healthcare, allowing us to make more informed decisions based on an individual's genetic makeup.
Exactly. And this is just the beginning. As our understanding of the human genome and proteome continues to grow, the applications of molecular diagnostics will only expand, paving the way for a more personalized and proactive approach to healthcare.
It's an exciting time to be alive, witnessing this convergence of biochemistry, genetics, and technology leading to transformative advances in medicine and our understanding of life itself.
Speaking of transformative advances, we can't leave out the groundbreaking field of proteomics.
Oh yeah, proteomics.
The study of all the proteins in a cell tissue or organism.
If DNA is the blueprint of life, then proteins are the workhorses, carrying out the instructions encoded in our genes. Understanding their intricate interactions and functions is crucial for unraveling the complexities of health and disease.
You're absolutely right. And proteomics is all about deciphering the language of proteins.
Oh, yeah.
Identifying them, quantifying them, studying their modifications, and understanding their complex networks of interactions.
So it's like taking a systems-level approach to studying proteins rather than just focusing on one at a time.
Precisely. And with the advancements in mass spectrometry, we can now analyze thousands of proteins, simultaneously giving us this global view of the protein landscape in a particular cell or tissue.
Wow, that's a lot of data. What kind of insights can we gain from proteomics?
We can use proteomics to identify biomarkers of disease, discover new drug targets, monitor treatment responses, and even shed light on the underlying mechanisms of complex biological processes.
It sounds like proteomics is a powerful tool for dissecting the molecular underpinnings of life.
It truly is. And by combining proteomics with genomics and other omics technologies, we can gain an even deeper understanding of the intricate interplay between genes, proteins, and the environment.
It's like putting together a giant jigsaw puzzle with each piece representing a different aspect of the molecular world.
Exactly. And as we continue to fit those pieces together, we're gaining a more holistic view of life itself, from its tiniest building blocks to its most complex systems.
Wow, we've really journeyed deep into the heart of the cell today. From those tiny nucleotides that make up DNA to the sophisticated techniques scientists use to study proteins, it's amazing how much we've learned.
Yeah, it's like we've gone from exploring the individual letters of the genetic alphabet to reading entire chapters of the Book of Life.
I love that analogy. But speaking of reading the Book of Life, we can't forget about the ethical considerations that come with unlocking these molecular secrets.
You're absolutely right. As we delve deeper into the intricacies of genetics and biotechnology, we inevitably encounter these questions about the responsible use of this knowledge.
Especially with technologies like CRISPR-Cas9, which gives us the power to edit DNA with incredible precision. It's both exhilarating and a bit daunting, you know, to think about the implications.
It certainly raises some profound questions about where we draw the line between therapeutic applications and genetic enhancement. For instance, using CRISPR to correct a genetic defect that causes a debilitating disease, that seems like a clear-cut benefit. But using CRISPR to enhance traits like intelligence or athletic ability, well, that ventures into a much grayer area.
Yeah, it does. Those are the kinds of conversations we need to have as a society, right?
Absolutely. Scientists, ethicists, policymakers, and the public all need to be involved in shaping the guidelines for how we use these powerful tools.
It's a reminder that scientific advancements don't happen in a vacuum. They have societal implications that we need to grapple with.
Precisely. As we continue to unlock the secrets of life, we must also consider the ethical dimensions of our discoveries and ensure that we use this knowledge wisely.
Well said. This deep dive has certainly given me a lot to ponder, not just about the science itself, but also about the broader impact of these discoveries on our lives and our future.
I'm glad to hear that. It's important to approach these topics with both curiosity and a critical eye.
Speaking of curiosity, I feel like this deep dive has only fueled my desire to learn more about biochemistry. It's such a dynamic and ever-evolving field.
I couldn't agree more. Every day, new discoveries are being made, pushing the boundaries of what we know about life itself.
It's exciting to think about what the future holds for biochemistry and the potential it has to transform our world. But for now, I think it's time to wrap up this deep dive and let all of this amazing information settle in.
Yes. Let it percolate and spark even more questions. After all, the journey of scientific discovery is never truly over. It's an ongoing exploration, fueled by curiosity and the pursuit of knowledge.
Well said. To our listeners out there, thanks for joining us on this incredible adventure into the world of biochemistry. We hope you've enjoyed unlocking these molecular secrets with us.
And remember, the exploration doesn't end here. Keep asking questions, keep learning, and keep diving deeper into the mysteries of life.